This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It is said that the truth will set you free. Of course, it is also said the good die young and home is where you hang your hat. Oh, and don't forget, good fences make good neighbors. All of these are phrases that have been handed down from generation to generation. Some we take with a big grain of salt, but others, as strange as they may seem, are given the benefit of the doubt because, after all, truth is stranger than fiction. Another old saying. This hour, we go out on a limb. We'll be skating on thin ice. We're going off the beaten path. We'll attempt to hit the nail on the head as we investigate the origins of some of the phrases that have been a part of our language for a very long time. Some of these sayings are as old as dirt. But we're not going to go off half-cocked or on a wing in a prayer. We've invited some experts because we don't know diddly squat about these things. But Ben Zimmer does, and so does Dr. Ralph Tita. Mr. Zimmer is executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and of Vocabulary.com. He's a language columnist for the Boston Globe and former on-language columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's also worked as an editor for American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press. He joins us from New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you with us. And Dr. Tita is an associate professor for applied linguistics at UNC Charlotte, who teaches theories of grammar, how language is acquired and processed in the brain, as well as medieval English literature. And some of these phrases go back to that point
sure
in time.
Do. Good morning. It's good to be here.
Yeah, welcome back. When Dan Rather anchored the CBS Evening News, and especially when he anchored election coverage, he had a reputation for peppering his analysis with hundreds of old Texas phrases, some of which sounded a bit bizarre to those of us who live outside the Lone Star State. But as Jimmy Durante would have said, he had a million of them. How many of these phrases are there out there? Does anybody want to hazard a guess, Ben?
Well, you can't really put a number on them because really you can make up new ones on the spot. The ones that Dan Rather said, the colorful Texanisms. There's a long, rich tradition of them, and part of what makes them so interesting is their creativity, which means that some of them may be old, but some of them might be new, and Dan Rather himself might have innovated and created some that became popular. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to put a number on something that can be so endlessly creative.
Can you put a number on them? I mean, given the fact that they go way, way, way back, probably to Adam and Eve.
Let me come from it in another way. An educated speaker of English would have about 60,000 entries in their vocabulary, and those phrases would be one of those entries. So that if you need a number, that'd be about it. But no point when you have to say my brain is full and I can't take any more.
So when you say entries, you're talking about words
and phrases.
And phrases.
Yeah, you'd have to memorize phrases like out of sight, out of mind, because I remember a Russian computer translating this into "invisible madman." If you don't know what the parts mean, right, you can't put it together. Yeah. So you have to memorize the whole chunk, and that's an entry.
So out of sight, out of mind is more than a phrase; it's an idiom.
Well, I would say so. Yeah.
Okay. So mm-hmm. so when you put idioms into computer translation devices, they don't come out the right way sometimes.
If you don't know them ahead of time, you're lost.
Now, you also, Ben, I believe, deal a lot in tracking down the origins of words, like for instance, waffle. I know that you tracked that one down. How does the search for the origins of words dovetail with the search for the origins of phrases, or does it?
Well, origins of words we typically think of as etymology, and you can, of course, track words through the different languages that they pass through. Sometimes words are borrowed from one language to another, or you know, it just may be part of the way that the general evolution of language has occurred as one language develops from another. But when you're looking at phrases, combinations of words, those tend to be more recent. The way that we combine pre-existing words to create interesting new turns of phrase. They can get settled into the language, become kind of fixed and crystallized in interesting ways. So idioms and proverbs are examples of that. And sometimes they get fixed in such a way that it becomes difficult for us now to understand what led to that. And so sometimes when we're faced with an idiom that doesn't really make much sense, the origins have been a bit lost in the mists of time, we sometimes come up with new explanations for why these might be. We're all kind of amateur etymologists, I think, and so a lot of people have a lot of fun with trying to figure out where do these idioms, where do these expressions come from. Sometimes they might be close to the mark, sometimes they might be wildly off the mark if you look at the evidence. And so it's fun to do the detective work to figure out where these things really come from.
And because some of these origins of phrases are lost in the mist of time, and some of them don't make sense to us really anymore, you as you uncover or you search for the origins, you're finding that some of these theories about where these started are sometimes simply not true, correct?
That's often the case, and so often it's a case of debunking popular theories about where idioms come from. If you take an example like the whole nine yards to mean sort of the whole thing, the whole kit and caboodle, or that's an expression that has dozens and dozens of theories that people have put forward. Does it have something to do with the capacity of a concrete truck if you measure it in cubic yards? Is it the amount of cloth you need for a Scottish kilt or a three-piece suit? Does it have something to do with World War II military equipment? Is it from how you measure an ammunition belt? Does it have to do with yardage in football? And on and on and on. There's so many different theories about this. And the frustrating thing in this case is we actually don't know the theory. The actual etymology of this one. We can throw out some that go back way in time, way far back in time, because this is actually a relatively new expression. There's just been some recent evidence of the whole nine yards going back to 1956, and that's the earliest known example. It might go back to World War II, which might help us with some of the possibilities, like having to do with a bomb rack or an ammunition belt or some other piece of military equipment. But we still don't know. We're still sort of tracking down and looking for clues. But we can throw out some theories that are just wildly off the mark.
You know, 1956 and the 1940s during the time of World War II are not that long ago. So why is it so difficult to track these things down?
Those would be easier because you have them in print. Lots of times these origins are oral. And see, in linguistics and in any other science, you've done a good job if your theory is falsifiable, if somebody can prove you wrong. Mm-hmm. And with an oral origin of a phrase, it's going to be really hard to pinpoint. You're always looking for the first occurrence in print, but what does that tell you?
I actually remember the first time I heard the whole nine yards.
Uh-huh.
And being puzzled by it because I thought, whole nine yards of what? And then I thought, well, maybe it's a football thing. But no, because football's 10 yards, first and 10, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, it can't be football. But then I started using the whole nine yards a lot. Is that how these things spread? People hear them, even if they don't understand them, they just seem to fit the need at the present to say something, so you say it, and that's how it spreads?
I think Ben could contribute a wonderful example here of where you can actually pinpoint where a saying got started, the list of horribles. Ben, would you want to comment on that one?
Yeah, that's something I wrote about recently, the parade of horribles, which some people might be familiar with that expression if they're lawyers, because it comes up in legal cases. If you're trying to say that the opposition on a particular case is just trying to use scare tactics or whatever, that they might give you a parade of horribles that suggests all the awful things that might happen if this judicial opinion goes forward, for instance. That came up in the Supreme Court healthcare case. But we can actually track that down to a particular procession in New England that still goes on today in some towns where they dress up in fanciful costumes. It was originally spoofing the artillery company that was called the Ancients and Honorables, and that got changed to the Antiques and Horribles. And so you can actually – it's a very fun kind of effort to put all that together and figure out exactly how it transformed from one thing to the other and tells you something about American history along the way. So that's always very satisfying when you can piece together a nice story like that. Unfortunately, in other cases like the whole nine yards, the story is incomplete. It could be because it was spread orally and we just don't have that original information about where it came from. And so we're left with just lots of competing theories, and it's not as satisfying as just coming up with one explanation for one where something comes from. But it turns out that we can use something like the whole nine yards without worrying too much about where it came from. It's an idiom. We understand what it means, even if we don't know exactly where it comes from.
Ben Zimmer is executive producer of Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com. He's also the chair of New Words of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society. And Dr. Ralph Tita is associate professor of applied linguistics at UNC Charlotte. What is applied linguistics?
Well, I may actually be the fifth wheel on the wagon in my department because I'm more in the theoretical. Applied would be, let's say, if you understand grammar and then see how a computer can use it or how a nurse can use it and talk to an Alzheimer patient, and basically the way in which you can make your knowledge of language put to work, make decisions based on it.
So is there an application of applied linguistics into what we're talking about this morning? In other words, if you understand how to use the language and how to make it work in certain situations, does that help you understand where words and phrases come from, how they are generated?
Well, I'm in it for understanding the human mind. I can give you a wonderful example that Steven Pinker came up with. He said that people, when they load hay into a wagon, they can load the wagon with hay. If you pour water into a glass, you can't pour the glass with water. And people actually don't make a mistake like this. So what is it in their minds that makes them understand how these idioms must work? Mm-hmm. And he traces them down to cognitive structures and how the thinking is reflected in the way that we speak. And that's what I'm fascinated by.
Now, you are obviously not from here. You're obviously from Virginia by your accent.
German, actually.
Does every language have its own sayings, its own idioms, like the ones we've been referring to somewhat here today?
Sometimes, surprisingly so, and sometimes it's even can get in the way of understanding each other. My favorite example is when the missionaries came to Arizona, and they wanted to translate the Bible into Hopi. And they had one story in particular that they found almost untranslatable at the time, mm-hmm. because the Hopi culture was so different. And that was the story of the prodigal son. There's this story of a son who asks for his inheritance paid out early. This wouldn't have worked in Hopi culture back then. What, you're going to get a cornfield, take it away? And then he was going to leave with that. not a good idea down there, because he would go into Navajo territory, and there are some tensions there. And then there was a big famine. Well, yeah, that's big news down there. And then he would come back and he would be greeted joyously. Now, I had a teacher in Germany who actually lived the Hopi several times, and I learned Hopi Indian from him. And he said, this is so frustrating. You come back after several years and your good friends are not going to be excited about it. They're just going to say, you're around, and that's it. That's the whole emotional greeting you get after 4 years of absence. So none of this prodigal son story made any sense if you try to translate it into Hopi. And sometimes our thinking is really that different, and our sayings are that different, and the culture that goes with one phrase is not there to understand it in another culture.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but are there examples where certain idioms and phrases do make the cut, do move from German to English or French to Italian?
I have one example. Yeah, okay. I could. I was just actually looking at the expression "break a leg," which is used in
actors.
The old theatrical superstition. Yeah. Yeah. Turns out that comes from German. There's a German expression meaning neck and leg break, Hals und Beinbruch, and that came into English perhaps through Yiddish, and that's where we got that from, probably.
Hals, Loche und Bruche. Got it.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more, and we'll tackle some of these phrases as we go through the program that you may have grown up with and still say today. Stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, showcasing the full line of all-wheel drive Subaru vehicles, including the all-new 36-mile-per-gallon 2012 Impreza. Information available at TyndallSubaru.com. Well, originally, the famous Hollywood sign high in the hills over America's movie capital read Hollywood Land. And if city fathers here have their way, the sign associated with movies will read Eastland, turning the old mall into a movie studio. It's just one of the ideas being floated. We'll talk about that in the first part of our program tomorrow. And then the brother and sister duo behind Die Roten Punta. I think that's how you say it. It keeps changing. It's the band spoofing the real band, the White Stripes. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the deadly Colorado shooting underscores the need to better identify, diagnose, and treat people with mental illness. The future of mental health services under the Affordable Care Act.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about origins of phrases, well-known phrases that we've grown up with. Ben Zimmer is executive producer of Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com, chair of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society, and Dr. Ralph Tita is associate professor of applied linguistics at UNC Charlotte. I would wager that the first people who use most of the phrases that we're talking about obviously understand the point of reference. Otherwise, they would not fall into popular use, although I never understood the whole nine yards and used it for quite a while when I was in college. How then do these origins fade in the mists of time? Why do we forget what they originally referred to?
Mm-hmm. We could probably monitor this as it's going to happen pretty soon. NASA is about to land a rover on Mars. And it's going to be taking 7 minutes to slow the descent from like 13,000 miles to a dead stop. And since the rover is about a car-sized, it's going to be quite a technical undertaking. So they are talking about the 7 minutes of terror. I would predict that this phrase is going to take hold for a while and then fade away as people forget about that accomplishment.
Well, there's another NASA phrase, and I've forgotten which one of you mentioned it in some of the stuff that I read yesterday. But Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah. That stuck, didn't it?
And yes, it's in general use, and people say it almost as a joke. Houston, we have a problem. They know they've got a problem here, but it makes people chuckle. But at the time it was originally said, it was no laughing matter at all. And I would think there are a lot of people out there who don't remember the original reference.
Unless they've seen the movie Apollo 13.
That's right. That's right.
Some of these cultural reference points may live on in films and TV shows even after the original source might fade. But there are older expressions that simply because of our changing culture and technology and so forth just no longer are relevant to our modern day experience. And sometimes when that happens, idioms can change slightly because people want them to make sense, and they look for ways to make them make sense in new ways. So, for instance, an expression like free rein, R-E-I-N, mm-hmm. Had to do with horses, horse riding, giving the horse enough of free rein in order to move around. But we don't ride horses anymore. And so if you hear that expression, free rein, you might not necessarily know that's spelled R-E-I-N. You might think, is it spelled R-A-I-N? Well, that doesn't make much sense. Mm-hmm. How about R-E-I-G-N? Well, that has to do with kings and queens, and you could imagine a monarch reigning freely over a land, and then you've made it, you've given it a new kind of sense. You might spell it differently, even if it's pronounced the same. And so idioms sometimes shift in these subtle ways as we try to invest them with meaning.
Now, here's another one. I think you wrote about this, Doctor, that is kind of like the Houston, we have a problem phrase. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, we had a string of incidences where postal employees were so upset that they went in and committed mayhem in some post offices.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was referred to quickly as going postal.
Going postal.
People now look at people who have temper tantrums and say, well, he went postal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a joke. It went from being a very serious thing to a kind of a frivolous way, shorthand of saying, well, he's a little off his game today.
Yeah, that may be a good thing.
Well, yes, it is. But why would we when a phrase is rooted in something heinous like going postal, why would we continue to use it, and why would we then shift it to something less heinous? Does anybody understand the workings behind
it's
that?
It's like whistling in the dark on a cemetery, right? I mean, you make it, you bring it down so that you don't have to be upset by it and you can cope. Language is a clever way of sharing with each other, and then if you have to cope with something as bad as, you know, a massacre in a post office, people will say very soon, this sounds horrible, but very soon they will start making jokes about it. I remember the Challenger jokes when the space shuttle went down.
Really? You know? I actually don't remember this. There's a very cool website that lists nearly 2,000 phrases, most of which we've all heard or used. No origins, just the phrases like you reap what you sow, you silly goose, hotter than a pistol, don't open that can of worms, betwixt and between, and between a rock and a hard place, and on and on and on. A lot of these just sound old-fashioned and folksy, and they certainly smack of folk wisdom. Why is that? Is that where they come from? Is that how new ones develop? They develop out of us, and therefore in 50 years our new phrases will also sound this way?
Well, the ones that sound like folk wisdom tend to be called proverbs, and proverbial expressions encapsulate a bit of wisdom or advice that you should follow. And so these often stick around in the language. Perhaps a mother will say it to a child, and the child learns it, and then the child will pass it on to his or her children, and it will just keep going in the language that way. There are actually new proverbs that develop as well. In fact, Yale University Press just recently published a wonderful reference book called The Dictionary of Modern Proverbs. And they didn't look at anything that originated any earlier than 1900. Mm. And so these are all 20th and 21st century expressions, new forms of folk wisdom that we're sharing. And so some of these proverbs obviously go back. You can trace them back to Middle English or even Old English. But this is the type of thing that people like to do with language, find a pithy expression that sums up a point or a bit of advice, and then share it with others, perhaps share it with your children, and they'll pass it on to the next generation.
Yeah, especially the sharing. I mean, I have to get personal now. A dear old friend of mine, a neighbor, passed away recently, Bill Laughlin, and he taught me a lot of those very colorful sayings around here. Like, for instance, a very heavy rain he referred to as a frog strangler. Or when something good happened to me, he said, now you're sitting in high cotton, which he didn't mean sitting. But anyway, so it is in the conversation that this comes out. I'm having here, I brought this with me, diaries written by a woman in York, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And it's 50 years, 1854 to 1901, by a woman who just lived down in York County. And a former student of mine, Catherine Michael, and her family transcribed this. I went through 50 years of this and I didn't find a single one of these expressions.
Really?
Nothing. As dry as can be, because it was just meant for herself. I would predict that these colorful expressions live in conversation where people take mutual delight and the wittiness of it all. Uh-huh. And you don't do this in diaries. You don't do this for your own purposes.
Because you're talking to yourself.
Yeah.
Ben Zimmer mentioned a second ago that some of these date back to Middle English. And I know medieval English is one of the things that you are interested in. Are there phrases that you can think of off the top of your head that originated in that period that we are still using today, even if we don't understand the original reference?
Well, as dead as a doornail would come to mind.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
14th century, right, for that one?
At least. And there's so many theories of what that doornail actually is.
Well, are we to assume that a doornail has been hit so many times on the head that it has to be dead? Is that
on the tail, maybe. One of the theories is that the door had several layers and they didn't have screws or rivets or good glue. So what they would do is take door nails and drive them all the way through the door.
Uh-huh.
And then the tip that sticks out on the inside, you clinch, you hammer down against the door. Right. So it's kind of like a rivet and holds the door together. But that's only one theory.
And that dates back, I think you wrote that dates back to 1350, Shakespeare, right?
Did I say that?
Well, 1350, it was used by Shakespeare, and then much earlier works from the 14th century. It can be found, and that's one of those expressions where you can theorize why a doornail as opposed to some other kind of nail. But another thing we have to think about with these expressions is that sounds good. It has alliteration in it. It has euphony. So the D of dead, or two D's in dead, and then followed up with doornail. Those assonance and alliteration, those euphonious sounds often contribute to these things sticking around in the language, and perhaps the meaning, why a doornail as opposed to some other sort of nail, is not so important as just the way that it sounds and the way people enjoy saying it.
And to prove this, there are various versions of this, as deaf as a doornail, as dumb as a doornail, as dull as a doornail, all starts with a D.
I've never heard deaf as a doornail.
Yeah, I've looked it up. So you get all these variants.
So I've heard dumb as a box of rocks.
That's got nice assonance to it, yeah.
Here's another phrase, I think, Ben, that you've expended a lot of digital ink, at least, on. I'm not sure you print anything anymore. The derivation of hot dog as a name for a wiener on a bun. So what did you – I've always wondered about this. What did you uncover about the derivation of hot dog?
Well, that's another expression that isn't too old, but there are lots of theories about it and a lot of stories that are just plain wrong. And so there's one popular story, for instance, that there was a cartoonist named Tad Dorgan who drew a cartoon at a baseball game at the Polo Grounds in New York, where they were selling Frankfurters, and he drew it as a dachshund, but he couldn't spell dachshund, and so he just wrote it as hot dog. Well, it turns out there's no evidence whatsoever that Tad Dorgan didn't draw a cartoon like that, and we can find examples predating that supposed 1901 baseball game. And now the earliest examples that we found come from 1892 in Paterson, New Jersey, where there was a hot dog seller named Hot Dog Morris, who was selling the Frankfurters on a roll, and that's the earliest example that we have so far. A lot of research has gone into this and to trying to figure out where it came from, how it developed, and the best theory now is that it had to do with some unfortunate jokes about sausage and how it was made in the 19th century.
So you're saying they were saying it was made out of dog meat?
Yes, yeah. And there were actual cases of, sausage makers who were found to use dog meat. It was pretty gross to think about. But it became a kind of a stereotype of sausage makers, where is this meat coming from? And so that helped to – that sort of encouraged this expression. We're piecing that story together too, and we found a number of examples from the 1890s now spreading in different parts of the – especially in the New York, New Jersey area.
So you're still searching for the origin of the name of the food, hot dog. But how do we go from the name of the food, hot dog, to the expression of enthusiasm, hot dog, or to to what happens in an end zone where a guy is accused of hot dogging in the end zone? How do we get there from the wiener on a bun?
That's an excellent question, and that's one that people are still figuring out as well. And in fact, the expression "hot dog" not to refer to the food, but to a show off, a person who's showing off in that way, actually goes back to the 1890s as well. The sources for this come from colleges, and so I believe the earliest example of that meaning comes from the University of Michigan, 1894. That's just a couple years after that. that, you know, we know that the food was being called that. And so there was some collegiate humor going on, I think, where you use this term that refers to a food and then you apply it to a person and then, you know, there can be – you can turn it into a verb. So you can say, oh, he was just hot-dogging it. That, again, shows some of the endless creativity of language where a new expression comes into the language and then before you know it, people are putting their own spin on it, giving different meanings to it, different parts of speech. And this is happening all the time in language.
We put a cartoon up on our website regarding a phrase that everybody knows, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Uh-huh. And it's a picture of a horse with his teeth showing brightly. Mm-hmm. And the caption says, it's the gift horse. And there's a little boy in the corner saying, oh my God, I looked into its mouth. Ahmad writes on our website, one mark of a healthy horse is its teeth.
Yeah.
Upon receiving the horse as a gift, no payment required. It would be rude to look into the horse's mouth for signs to assess its overall condition.
So that's age, too.
And age,
The gum line recedes as the horse ages, so you can tell the age.
Now, I'm curious about the role of computerization, digitization of old print materials, and what that's doing for the for people like you who can look back, who want to look back and look at the derivation of these words and phrases. Is this being monstrously helpful? Is it speeding up the tempo at which we are uncovering the origins of things?
It definitely is. And in fact, many of the examples that I've given so far, the earliest examples that we know, for instance, a hot dog or a whole nine yards, these early citations are coming from searching on digitized databases of newspapers, magazines, books, and so forth. People might be familiar with the Google Books project, where they've scanned and digitized millions of books from different research libraries. And so we have all of this new searchable evidence, this new data at our fingertips. Before, it would have been extremely difficult to try to figure these things out. Often researchers had to go through microfilm to find newspaper examples. So for instance, hot dog, there were hours and hours of work that was put into looking for that apocryphal cartoon, for instance, that never materialized. But now we can just look at a digitized database of newspapers and find these examples from the 1890s, which just would have been impossible to find before.
Yeah. As long as you're patient, though, because I also looked through Google Books recently, tried to track down nerd.
The word nerd.
Uh-huh. And Google Books, some of these books go back to the 1500s, and I found hits in the 1600s and 1500s. I said, wow. And it turns out those were OCR misreads for the words herd or need or something like this, and they came up as nerd.
OCR is optical character recognition.
That's right.
And just in case people don't know. But did you not do a column, Ben, on the word nerd?
I did. Yeah, that's another term that isn't that old, but people have lots and lots of different explanations for where it might come from. And another one where currently we just have to say origin unknown. Mm-hmm. There was a Dr. Seuss book from 1950 where a nerd appears, If I Ran the Zoo. But it was already being used in teen slang in 1951, just a year after Dr. Seuss's book came out. And so it seems a little unlikely that it would have made the transition so quickly. And so nerd has this evocative sound, but there are other terms like dork or dweeb, these terms that we use for people kind of who are maybe not the most social people. And they have these funny sounding terms where it's not completely clear where it came from, but it's evocative in a certain way. For instance, you know, another theory has it that it has something to do with Mortimer Snerd, the dummy mannequin,
Jerry Mahoney.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But probably snerd and nerd. I mean, they just have a particular sound, and that contributes to people using it and it circulating in slang.
Was Jerry Mahoney the dummy or was he the ventriloquist? I can't remember, but because he had two. He had the smart dummy and he had Mortimer Snerd. It was not the smart.
I wouldn't have the stomach to answer that one.
I can't remember. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on Paul Winchell was the guy with Jerry Mahoney and Mortimer Snerd. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hands for Hire weatherization experts, offering home energy audits, providing energy efficient improvements like eliminating high heat in attics through ventilation and insulation. Details and appointments, handsforhire.com. The deadly Colorado shooting underscores the need to better identify, diagnose, and treat people with mental illness. And Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the future of mental health services under the Affordable Care Act in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about old sayings, well, now's your time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, and online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. Let's say you wanted to support your station with something other than cash.
Well, I'd donate my time.
I have a restraining order against you. The answer is you could donate your used car.
Right. You get a tax deduction, a nice empty driveway, and the station gets the proceeds.
To arrange a pickup, call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ben Zimmer is with us, executive producer of Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com. Dr. Ralph Tita in our studio, associate professor of applied linguistics at UNC Charlotte. Since your expertise goes back to Middle English, which nobody can read or understand, except maybe you, it would be hard to do a digitized search for the origins of phrases that date, that we still use today, that date back to that period, because they would be spelled differently. They would probably be pronounced differently. They would probably be totally different words in some cases, wouldn't they?
Yeah, the search gets trickier, but we do have scanned digital resources.
So if you go back to Middle English, what can, maybe you've already done this, but give me an example of a phrase that we might still have in somewhat general use today that might be different in Middle English, but it's the same idea or the same phrase when you come right down to it.
I remember somebody complaining about a defeat in battle, and the injuries received were like fleas in his ear. And we still have that expression today, a flea in one's ear.
See, I thought that came from the title of a play.
Well, why not? I mean, certainly it is a must title have been used.
Sure,
right. There's also a title called The Nerd.
That's exactly right. With Larry Shue.
Right, you know that.
Yeah. And I think you've written about a flea in their ear, Ben.
Well, I haven't written about that one, but yeah, that is a case where it goes back a long ways, with this idea of having a flea in your ear. And actually, you can find it in other European languages where it can mean putting a suspicion into your head or just to irritate you. And so it's something kind of cross-culturally that people have picked up on.
So it's like Jiminy Cricket and Pinocchio.
Hey, I should mention, just to correct the record so you don't get angry calls about this,
okay.
Edgar Bergen was the ventriloquist who had the dummy Mortimer Snurd.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you very much. Paul Winchell had Jerry Mahoney and somebody. And
there
and
you
another.
Go.
I think maybe he stole half his act from Edgar Bergen, probably. Travel Gal on our website writes, www.goenglish.com has an explanation of idioms, but usually doesn't explain the origins. A couple of idioms that come to mind that no longer make sense. Don't buy a pig in a poke. Uh-huh. And the proof is in the pudding. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about pig in a poke, because I think that shows up in a couple of different languages, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know it from German and from French. A poke is a sort of a burlap bag. And the pig is really a piglet that you bring to a medieval market, and they don't really stand still, so you would put them in a bag. And you'd probably not be wise to open the bag, because the pig will come out and there goes your purchase. So you had to trust the seller of actually having a piglet
in the
bag. And sometimes they would put a cat in there, apparently. The French have the same saying, you know, acheter un cochon en poche. It's exact same wording. Mm-hmm. In German, when you realize what the surprise is, it's die Katze aus dem Sack lassen, to let the cat out of the bag.
Ah.
right? Right. So you got duped. And so you trust somebody if you buy a pig in a poke from.
Right. But do you think that don't let the cat out of the bag and don't buy a pig in a poke are the same, they come from the same practice?
It's the same deception.
Yeah.
It seems to have been widespread because all those languages have expressions like that.
Does anybody know the origin or the reason behind the proof is in the pudding?
Ben?
Well, I do know that the full expression is the proof of the pudding is in the eating.
Ah.
And that full expression goes back to the early 17th century. And proof in that case, it actually meant more like a test. So you test out the pudding by eating it, and that's how you know whether it's any good, I guess. So that has now come to mean something different now that the word proof, we tend to think of that to mean evidence that's conclusive in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So that's one way that we can see there's an old expression which takes on a different twist because the meaning of the word proof has changed a bit, and so the meaning of the whole expression changes with it.
Charlotte from Matthews emails wait a minute. I'll do that one later. Excuse me. Adam emails, hang up the phone is a recent example. So no one will hang up the phone today. We just press end. And there are a bunch of phrases that date from 20th century technology that is being that's being replaced by 21st century technology. For instance, we struggle in this business with how to tell somebody that our source would not speak to us on tape. We don't use tape anymore. Mm-hmm. We just record them digitally on a chip. So you can't say they won't speak to us on our chip. So we continue to use the phrase on tape. And you don't dial a phone anymore. So there are things that we still say that I'm sure that to kids today make no sense at all. How quickly are we changing rapidly?
Or taking it down a notch, right, which was different in the transmission of an old vehicle, just to choose a lower gear. Right?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. With things like technology, though, obviously those can change very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so we hang up the phone, dial the phone. Yeah. You could still talk about dialing the phone, even though phones haven't had dials for quite a while now. And so when the technology is introduced, sometimes there's a whole set of terms that go along with it. But then the technology can change. Phones are no longer what they once were.
Yeah, they don't ring. They don't
exactly.
ring anymore.
But yeah, the terms that we used when the technology first entered the culture stick with us even after the technology changes.
Judy emails, please, please, please discuss the origin of throw you under the bus. I've looked it up, but I can't find any verified definition. Can either of the two of you? I hear you typing furiously in the background, Ben.
It's funny because I've looked into these expressions, so much that they're all kind of floating in my head, and sometimes I need to remember exactly, what's been done on this. So actually, throw someone under the bus is pretty recent. I'm showing 1991 for the exact expression "throw someone under the bus," but if you there were slight variants on that expression going back to the 1980s to push someone or shove someone mm-hmm. under the bus. Mm-hmm. Cyndi Lauper used it in 1984. there are different expressions that are just might vary by a word like that, but you can understand that how that expression. To sort of sacrifice someone for your own gain, if there's something colorful, a colorful metaphor like mm-hmm. that could appeal to a lot of people. And then before you know it, it's become a cliche. We hear it all the time in politics and other areas of public life now. Everybody's talking about, oh, he got thrown under the bus. He was sort of sacrificed because someone else has selfish aims.
Well, at one point, even throw you under the bus was a new phrase. It was brand new, in fact. Mm-hmm. B-R-A-N-D or B-R-A-N. The question is, which is the correct spelling? And then something can also be brand spanking new.
Yeah.
Where do these things come from? Why brand new or brand spanking new?
Well, the D would be uncertain if it starts orally brand new.
Uh-huh.
I mean, do you hear a D?
No.
It could be either from the old participle from burn, which used to be brennen in Old English, so brennt, brand. So it's like something is so new, it comes fresh out of, I don't know, the kiln or the forgery, right? It's brand new.
Right.
Or if it's just brand new, that brand may actually be from a way of shipping fragile stuff, let's say porcelain from Japan or something. And we wouldn't have had those foam peanuts that we use nowadays, right? So they would put bran in there, wheat bran. And then something is so new that he just unpacked it from the crate and still has bran on it. It's brand new.
Interesting.
That's one I've looked into, actually. That first explanation with brand having to do with wood fresh out of the fire is the actual historical origin for that one. But over time, this it had a variant where you drop the D, so it becomes brand new. And because of that, this new explanation came up where people talk about, for instance, well, you have to pack items with bran and while they're in transit. But that's a later explanation for an older term. And then with brand spanking new, people think, oh well, spanking, that must have something to do with spanking a baby when the baby is newly born. But that's another after the fact explanation where, in fact, spanking is sort of an emphatic adjective to describe something big or impressive, and that long predates the whole idea that the doctor spanks the baby when it's newly born. And in fact, since it comes from British English, British people don't even use the word spank in that way. They might say slap the baby, but spanking is just for punishment, so it wouldn't even make sense.
And spanking is repeated, right? Slap is just one little slap, so you wouldn't spank a baby.
Right.
Well, now you've opened a can of worms. And speaking of which, where did that come from, opening a can? Don't open that can of worms.
Well, I think for that one, it literally comes from the kind of a can of worms that you would someone fishing would use for bait. Again, a very evocative image of someone opening that can of worms for bait, and then once it's open, well, you might have a hard time getting the worms back in the can. So it becomes a metaphor that's similar to Pandora's box. Something, once you open it, it's difficult to get the contents back into it.
Let's see here. Pebbles on the web writes, are your guests familiar with the egg corn debate, EGGCORN, the egg corn database? It's a site that tracks down sayings and words that have gotten messed up along the way. For instance, when all is said and done, instead of said and done. I don't understand that. Oh, all is set and done instead of said and done. Egg corn is an example of something that should be an acorn, but I guess an acorn is an egg in a way, isn't it?
That's something I'm pretty familiar with. I'm actually one of the main contributors to the Eggcorn database online. So, and in fact, that example is one that I entered into the database. When all is said and done, S-A-I-D, said and done. Mm-hmm. But it sounds very much like when all is set and done, S-E-T, set and done. So that's an idiom where if you just change it just a bit, said and set sound very similar, then you've changed it a bit, but it still makes sense. It makes sense in a new way. And in the same way, that word egg corn is a way that some people have spelled the word acorn under the thinking that, well, it's sort of egg-shaped. And so why not, you know, maybe that's how it's supposed to be. And especially in parts of the country where the word egg, A-E-G-G, is pronounced as egg, then they're actually quite similar, egg corn and acorn. Mm. And so because of that, this started on LanguageLog, a blog that I contribute to, when that was noticed, then that became the term that was used for any of these reshapings of words or phrases that give new sense to something that might be semantically opaque. Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating. If you go to the Acorn database, you can just Google for it, you'll find that we have hundreds and hundreds of examples that we've collected. And they're really actually quite creative, even if they're non-standard forms of idioms and people say, well, that's wrong. Well, yeah, they're wrong, but they're wrong in a very interesting way.
Amy emails, just wondering if it's a Midwesternism, but my father used one that I like that seems to take people by surprise. When asked the common question, how are you? He used to reply, finer than frog fuzz. I'm wondering if he made it up. it would have been like him to do that, or if it's an older expression or maybe just regional. Have you heard of I'm finer than frog fuzz before?
That would be very fine.
All right. I would give my eye teeth if you knew the answer to that, but why would anybody give their eye teeth for any reason? Where did that expression come from? No one knows it. No one has an answer for that. You all have egg on your face now. Why would you have egg on your
face? The eye teeth would stand for experience because they're right under the eyes. So if somebody has eye teeth in the business world, he would have savvy. And if you give your eye teeth, then you would give up all your advantage in order to get something. Mm-hmm. But I'm just speculating.
Well, I'll be a monkey's uncle.
Yes.
Which, of course, leads me to the next question.
Yeah. The monkey's uncle.
Yeah.
That's the original version.
There's a theory that which seems kind of plausible that with monkey's uncle, it goes back to the debates that Charles Darwin was having with those who did not believe in the theory of evolution. Thomas Huxley was a famous interlocutor with Darwin, who sort of debated about Darwin's Origin of Species back then, and so Huxley supposedly was asking Darwin, well, was it through my grandfather or my grandmother that I'm descended from a monkey? So this idea of a monkey being your ancestor came about then. But it was only later in the 1920s that we get the expression, well, I'm a monkey's uncle. But it could be from those debates over evolution.
Ron emails, I just finished reading Don Quixote and have been hoping to find why it is so highly thought of. One continuous pattern throughout the novel is Sancho Panza sprinkling his conversation with sayings, most of which don't fit the situation. Similarly, he is routinely criticized by Quixote for doing this while Quixote himself does the same thing. Have your guests any comments on this? Is it historical commentary on the overuse of sayings as far back as the 1600s, or is it just something for comedy's sake, do you think?
Sheridan wrote a play in which there's a character called Mrs. Malaprop, and we have malapropisms from that. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful way of having a comical character, is for them to misuse language and use words in the wrong way.
And we could also think of the character of Polonius from Hamlet, who didn't mangle the expressions but just came up with endless sort of cliched, hackneyed expressions that for Shakespeare's audience was comical, because it's like, oh, all of this wisdom that he thinks is so profound. And so another way to find humor in language.
Well, it's time to throw in the towel. We have no time left. Zilch, as it were. And that's another couple of phrases that I wanted to get the answers to, but we don't have time for that. Ben Zimmer, executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus, Vocabulary.com, a contributor to Eggcorn Database, and the chair of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society, joined us from New York. Dr. Ralph Tita, associate professor of applied linguistics from UNC Charlotte. Thank you both for the hour.
That was fun.
Thank you.